voter fraud, absent any evidence. At some point, you have to prove your hypothesis about what's going on. All right, troll man, please, and thank you. We have a great bonus show for you today. Russia may be bracing for a default and rapidly approaching one. We will talk about the impact it may have. Connecticut has passed a bill to make the state a safe haven for abortion providers, the opposite of what's happening in Oklahoma, as we talked about earlier. And Joe Biden's support among Gen Z and millennials is collapsing. Why is it collapsing? We will talk about it and more on today's bonus show. Please sign up at joinpacman.com to get instant access to the bonus show. You'll also get the daily show 6 hours earlier than everybody else when you are a member. Sign up at joinpacman.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Technoland? RCT Techno DJs in the house! Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh. Right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Word to your mother.
RCT in sound from way out.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Nuclear Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
RCT Pittsburgh. Meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call, jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? RCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCT Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
They are not going to get away with this. Let me say that I don't care what I have to do, but they're not going to do this to D.C., and they are not going to do this to America. There's more of us than there is of them, and we are going to fight.
The Supreme Court has voted to overturn Roe v. Wade, this according to the news outlet Politico, which has published an unprecedented leaked draft of the court's majority decision. In the document, Justice Samuel Alito writes, "We hold that Roe and Casey must be overruled." We'll speak to attorney Catherine Kitty Colbert, who argued the landmark 1992 Planned Parenthood versus Casey case, as well as to law professor Michelle Goodwin, author of Policing the Womb. Then, as President Biden seeks $33 billion more dollars for Ukraine, we'll look at the dangers of U.S. military escalation with Medea Benjamin of Code Pink and George Beebe of the Quincy Institute. He's the former head of Russia analysis at the CIA and a former advisor to Vice President Dick Cheney.
We're talking more and more openly about weakening Russia's military, marginalizing Russia in the world, about Russia's strategic defeat. This is a shift that I think is fraught with danger of escalation into direct U.S.-Russian military conflict.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A majority of Supreme Court justices are prepared to overturn abortion rights, according to a leaked Supreme Court draft opinion published by Politico. The document is an internally circulated majority draft opinion written by Justice Samuel Alito that would strike down Roe v. Wade entirely, the landmark 1973 ruling that legalized abortion nationwide. In the draft, Alito also moves to overturn Planned Parenthood versus Southeastern Pennsylvania versus Casey, Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania versus Casey, the 1992 decision that upheld Roe v. Wade. The draft majority opinion reads, quote, "Roe was egregiously wrong from the start. We hold that Roe and Casey must be overruled. It's time to heed the Constitution and return the issue of abortion to the people's elected representatives," unquote. The leaked opinion suggests five conservative justices would vote to overturn Roe, with Justices Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett joining Alito. Hundreds of protesters rallied outside the Supreme Court Monday evening after news of the court's draft opinion broke.
This is really just tearing apart everything that we've worked for and everything, all the change that we've worked for to happen. You know, it really just feels like all the work we put into was just torn up and thrown in the garbage. And it's honestly ridiculous to me because of how far we've come for it to just be set back in time. Like it feels like I jumped in a time machine and went back.
If Roe is overturned, 13 states have so-called trigger laws that would make abortion illegal as soon as the court rules. We'll get the latest after headlines. Ukrainian officials are attempting to resume the mass evacuation of civilians from Mariupol after the mayor of the besieged city said more than 200 civilians, including about 20 children, remain trapped by Russian strikes in a shelter under a massive steel plant. In Odessa, a 14-year-old boy was killed after a Russian rocket struck a strategically important bridge in the Black Sea port city. Elsewhere, Ukrainian officials said at least 9 civilians were killed by Russian fire in the Donetsk region. The UN's Human Rights Office said Monday the number of confirmed civilian deaths since the start of Russia's invasion has topped 3,000, though the death toll is likely much higher. Today, President Biden's visiting a Lockheed Martin plant in Alabama that manufactures Javelin anti-tank missiles that the U.S. is supplying to Ukraine. His trip comes after the Pentagon said Russian President Vladimir Putin could formally declare war on Ukraine as soon as May 9th, the Russian holiday known as Victory Day, which commemorates the Soviet Union's defeat of Nazi Germany in 1945. A declaration of war would further free up Putin to mobilize Russia's reserve forces and draft more conscripts. So far, Putin has only referred to the invasion as a special military operation. We'll have the latest on Russia's invasion of Ukraine later in the broadcast. The European Union's top energy official has rejected a scheme by foreign companies to convert their payments for Russian oil and gas into rubles. EU Energy Commissioner Kadri Simpson said Monday the arrangement violates European Union sanctions imposed after Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
Paying in rubles through the conversion mechanism managed by the Russian public authorities and a second dedicated account in Gazprom Bank is a violation of the sanctions and cannot be accepted.
In Berlin, two government ministers said Monday Germany's prepared to reverse its opposition to a ban on Russian oil and is prepared to suffer the economic shock of an EU oil embargo. Germany continues to import about a quarter of the oil it consumes and more than a third of its natural gas from Russia. COVID-19 cases are rising again in South Africa in what public health officials worry could be a sign of things to come in other nations, including the United States. South Africa's fifth coronavirus wave is being fueled by the BA4 and BA5 subvariants of the Omicron variant, which swept the world after it was first detected in Southern Africa last November. The latest variants have mutations that appear to help them evade people's immune responses to other variants, including earlier forms of Omicron. In China, authorities reported 58 new coronavirus cases in Shanghai outside of areas of the city under strict lockdown. It's the latest blow to China's zero COVID strategy and comes after Beijing canceled celebrations and public gatherings around the May Day holiday in order to press ahead with mass testing for millions of residents in China's capital city. New York City has raised its COVID-19 risk level to medium as cases continue a steady rise across the U.S. led by northeastern states. Officially, New York City is recording about 2,500 new cases a day, but those numbers are likely a significant undercount due to the growth of at-home testing. On Monday, Mayor Eric Adams, who recently recovered from COVID-19, said he isn't prepared to close down the city again, but would consider reimposing public health measures like mask mandates and requiring proof of vaccination at some venues. Human rights groups say there's mounting evidence El Salvador's authorities have been committing serious violations since a state of emergency was imposed in late March in response to rising homicides attributed to gangs. Human Rights Watch and the Salvadoran-based Cristosal say at least two people have died in custody, while Salvadoran media is reporting the death of at least three others. Over 22,000 people have been arrested in just over a month, with many relatives saying they aren't informed of their loved ones' whereabouts. There's also evidence of police and soldiers beating people in custody. Thousands remain in pretrial detention, including dozens of children. The Biden administration said Monday it's disturbed by reports that a prominent critic of Egypt's government died in the custody of security forces after he was forcibly disappeared in February. Ayman Hadood died a month after his arrest, but his family only learned of his death in mid-April when they were asked to collect his body from a psychiatric hospital in Cairo. Authorities claimed he died of a chronic heart condition, but leaked photos of the body suggest Hadood had a broken skull and showed signs he was tortured before his death. On Monday, State Department spokesperson Ned Price responded to the reports.
We are deeply disturbed by reports surrounding the death in custody of Egyptian researcher Ayman Hadood and allegations of his torture while in detention. The circumstances of his detention, his treatment, of his death, we think require a thorough, transparent, and credible investigation without delay. We have made clear, including with our Egyptian partners, that human rights are a priority.
In January, the Biden administration said it would cancel $130 million in military aid to Egypt over human rights concerns. However, it made the pledge just days after the U.S. approved a far more massive weapons sale to Egypt, worth $2.5 billion. President Biden met Monday with the parents of Austin Tice, the freelance journalist and former U.S. Marine abducted in Syria nearly a decade ago. In a statement, the White House said Biden pledged to Tice's family he would continue to work through all available avenues to secure Austin's release. Tice was working as a freelance journalist in 2012 when he was abducted whilst covering Syria's civil war. Later that year, a video posted to a pro-government website showed Tice blindfolded, looking distressed and surrounded by men armed with machine guns. Earlier this month, his mother, Deborah Tice, told Houston Public Media the biggest roadblock to securing her son's release is no longer the Syrian government. She said, quote, "It breaks my heart to tell you the Syrians are not the obstacle now. The obstacle is really in Washington, D.C., unquote. To see our interview with the Tice family, go to democracynow.org. The Committee to Protect Journalists is demanding the release of Ethiopian journalists Desudala and Bikila Amenu. The pair faced the death penalty on charges of outrages against the Constitution after they documented wars and human rights abuses committed in Ethiopia's Tigray and Oromia regions. The call for their release came ahead of World Press Freedom Day. At the Vatican, Pope Francis paid tribute to journalists during his weekly address Sunday.
On May 3rd, UNESCO's World Press Freedom Day will be celebrated. I pay homage to journalists who pay in person for this right. Last year, 47 journalists were killed and more than 350 were jailed around the world. A special thanks to those who, with courage, keep us informed about humanity's wounds.
Reporters Without Borders has ranked the United States 42nd out of 180 nations in its annual Press Freedom Index, warning violations in the U.S. are increasing at a troubling rate. It cited the disappearance of local news, the polarization of the media, and the weakening of journalism and democracy caused by digital platforms and social networks, unquote. Hong Kong's Press Freedom Index ranking plummeted to 148th as China's central government adopted a national security law aimed at silencing independent voices. Meanwhile, Russia's press freedom ranking fell to near the bottom as the Kremlin launched a massive disinformation campaign to support its invasion of Ukraine, where officials say at least 20 journalists and media workers have been killed or injured. Today is World Press Freedom Day. Much of New Mexico is under a critical fire alert today after gusty winds and dry conditions pushed a massive wildfire toward the town of Las Vegas, home to 13,000 people. The fire is already on track to become the largest and most destructive in New Mexico's recorded history. Some 90% of the western United States is in drought, with officials warning of an extended wildfire season due to the worsening climate emergency. Tennessee has halted 5 executions through the end of the year. While an investigation is underway into the state's failure to properly test its lethal injection drugs, the execution of 72-year-old Oscar Smith was stopped yesterday, an hour before he was scheduled to be killed, because the drugs had not been tested for the contaminants endotoxins, which could trigger respiratory failure or other distressing symptoms if injected. Here in New York, Amazon workers at a second Staten Island warehouse have voted against forming a union. There were 380 votes in favor, while over 600 opposed. This comes a month after an adjacent Amazon warehouse in Staten Island successfully formed Amazon's first union in the United States. Organizers vowed to keep fighting. This is Derek Palmer, Amazon Labor Union's Vice President of Organizing.
We've been organizing, campaigning for a long time, put in a lot of work, so we shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't be discouraged at all. You know, we have other buildings, we have over 100 buildings throughout the U.S. that want to organize, and they want to unionize. You know, we already set the tone with JFK, so we just got to continue. That's all it's about.
To see our interview with Derek Palmer and Christian Smalls, you can go to democracynow.org. Eric Milner, an attorney representing the Amazon Labor Union, accused Amazon of illegal union-busting tactics and promised to appeal the election's results to the National Labor Relations Board.
Fortunately, Amazon really stepped up the pressure here in the last couple of weeks. They engaged in a lot of unlawful behavior, just constant coercive meetings with employees. They disciplined our organizers. They disciplined other workers for engaging in coercive activity. And they really made it as difficult as possible.
And an Oklahoma judge has ruled that a lawsuit seeking reparations for the 1921 Tulsa race massacre may proceed. Tulsa County District Court Judge Carolyn Wall made the ruling Monday in a packed courtroom as survivors Leslie Benningfield Randall, Viola Fletcher, and Hughes Van Ellis looked on. All three survivors are over 100 years old. Over a span of 18 hours, beginning May 31, 1921, a white mob burned down what was known as Black Wall Street, the thriving African-American neighborhood of Greenwood in Tulsa. An estimated 300 African-Americans were killed. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we look at the Politico bombshell report that the Supreme Court has voted to overturn Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. We'll get response from the lawyer that argued Casey, Catherine Kitty Colbert, and law professor Michelle Goodwin, author of Policing the Womb. Stay with us. By Excuse 17. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
The Supreme Court has voted to overturn abortion rights. This, according to a leaked Supreme Court draft opinion published Monday night by Politico. The document is an internally circulated majority draft opinion that was written by Justice Samuel Alito that would strike down Roe v. Wade, the landmark decision that's guaranteed federal constitutional protections of abortion rights for half a century. In the draft, Alito also moves to overturn Planned Parenthood versus Casey, a 1992 decision credited with upholding Roe v. Wade. Alito writes, quote, "Roe was egregiously wrong from the start. We hold that Roe and Casey must be overruled. It's time to heed the Constitution and return the issue of abortion to the people's elected representatives," unquote. The leaked opinion suggests five conservative justices would vote to overturn Roe. Justice Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, and Amy Coney Barrett joining Alito. CNN reports Chief Justice John Roberts does not want to completely overturn Roe v. Wade, but he would vote to uphold the Mississippi law that bans abortion at 15 weeks of pregnancy. If Roe is overturned, 13 states have so-called trigger laws that would make abortion illegal as soon as the court rules. They're among the more than 26 states the Guttmacher Institute says are likely to ban abortion as soon as possible. Alabama, Arizona, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Idaho, Indiana, Iowa, Kentucky, Louisiana, Montana, Michigan, Mississippi, Missouri, Nebraska, North Dakota, Ohio, Oklahoma, South Carolina, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, West Virginia, Wisconsin, and Wyoming. For more, we're joined by two guests. Michelle Goodwin is the Chancellor's Professor at University of California, Irvine, founding director of the Center for Biotechnology and Global Health Policy, author of Policing the Womb, Invisible Women, and the Criminalization of Motherhood. Also with us from Portland, Oregon, is Catherine Kitty Colbert, longtime public interest attorney who argued the landmark case of Planned Parenthood versus Casey before the U.S. Supreme Court in 1992, which is credited with upholding Roe v. Wade. She's co-founder of the Center for Reproductive Rights and co-author of Controlling Women, What We Must Do Now to Save Reproductive Freedom. Well, we're going to go there in a second, Kitty Colbert. We're going to begin with you and just get your response to this astounding at every level, unprecedented release of a first draft of a decision, in this case, one that apparently was written in February and circulated to the court that would overturn Roe v. Wade, written by Samuel Alito. Can you respond to what you've read?
Well, it's a stunning opinion. And let me just say, I fully expected that this court would overrule Roe and Casey. That is not in contention. There has always been, since the confirmation of the Trump justices, the very strong likelihood that this would happen. But I think that the breadth of the decision, the way that they have articulated their views on this issue, are so disturbing on a whole host of levels. First and foremost, they leave open the possibility of not just eradicating abortion rights, but of eradicating all of the rights in which women have depended, reproductive rights such as the ability to use contraception, the ability to be sexual with somebody of the same sex, the ability to marry for same-sex couples. Because what they say is the 14th Amendment does not include a right to privacy, and that unless there is a long history of support for those rights, it will not be considered within the panoply of protected interests. That means that any right such as gay marriage, which has been undermined by state laws for centuries prior to the ruling last decade, are in jeopardy, and that's extraordinarily disturbing. But let me just add one more thing, Amy, and which is this is really disturbing for women on all levels. First and foremost, women immediately facing unintended pregnancies, they need to know that abortion is still legal in many places, all except Texas and perhaps Oklahoma. But the day is coming that it soon will not be. And second, I think we need to figure out a way to make sure that all of the women in the country who are so angry about this take political action, because the only way to respond is to vote out all of the Republicans who have made this happen at the state level, at the federal level, at the every level of our government. And we need to do that as soon as possible. There are elections, this month all the way through November.
And Kitty Colbert, we've listed all of the states that are ready to act as soon as this decision came down. But what about those states that would seek to, in one way or another, protect abortion for women? What do you see happening there?
Well, I think that's very good. It's important for us to realize, however, that geographically, those who oppose abortion will stretch from, say, Georgia all the way west to Texas, and from Idaho all the way south to the Mexican border. And therefore, the states that are protective are too often on the coasts or far away from the places in which women will be unable to obtain procedures. And so the important thing is women are going to have to travel long, long distances, even if there are safe access points. And second, that the ability to travel is limited to those people who have means. And so, yes, it's great that California and New York and Illinois and a variety of other coastal states are protecting women's rights. I hope more and more will do so. But the important thing is it is the women who are least able to travel, the women who are low income, who are young, who are living in rural areas, who don't have access to public transportation, who are, for any number of reasons, unable to leave their jobs for, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 days in order to get across the country to exercise their reproductive rights. These women, the most vulnerable, who are too often women of color, let's be clear here, because they suffer from discrimination in the healthcare system, those women are significantly disadvantaged, and we need to make sure, A, that we help them in every way we can, but B, that we turn around the politics in the bad states so that this no longer happens.
I'd like to bring into the conversation as well Michelle Goodwin, Chancellor's Professor at the University of California, Irvine. Welcome to Democracy Now, Professor Goodwin. Your response to this this leaked decision of the Supreme Court?
First of all, thank you so much for having me back on the show. This is unprecedented that there would be a leaked document coming from the United States Supreme Court. But let's be clear that these are incredibly unprecedented times that we find ourselves in the United States, with an insurrection to overturn the results of an election last year, and now with the Supreme Court seeking to potentially gut Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey. This is a first draft of an unpublished opinion, so we don't actually know what will happen, but very likely, given this draft, we will see the undoing of Roe v. Wade. And it's important that we understand that with the undoing of Roe v. Wade, just what's at stake in the United States for our democracy and the rule of law. And if we look at this within the context of our democracy and the rule of law, you see the potential for the Supreme Court to do a bit of cherry picking around equality issues, around privacy issues, about matters that relate to autonomy with people's bodies. You also see the Supreme Court seeking to skirt empirical data that has emerged in years since Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey. What is crystallized is that the World Health Organization has said that an abortion is as safe as a penicillin shot. An abortion, surgical abortion, one of the safest medical procedures that a person could have. But even more than that, when we look at rates of maternal morbidity and mortality in the United States, then this opinion is absolutely shocking. As shocking as and horrific as we see the state-level anti-abortion laws. A woman is 14 times more likely to die in the United States by carrying a pregnancy to term than by terminating it. And so if we fail to include that in our conversation, then we're missing what essentially is a death sentence for many women across the United States and girls. And let me add one layer to that. For Black women, they're 3.5 times more likely to die due to maternal mortality in the United States than their white counterparts. That is a national figure. That actually doesn't tell us all that we need to know when we actually look at states like Mississippi, Texas, Alabama, Louisiana, where Black women may be 5 times, 10 times, even 17 times more likely to die in certain cities and counties in those states than their white counterparts. And so this is not just a political performance or kind of partisanship way beyond ideology that we see coming from the Supreme Court. What we see is something that is very graphic in terms of what it will illustrate in terms of maternal morbidity and mortality. And let me add one last piece to that as well, is that this is not something that is conjecturing. This is actually coming from data from the CDC and from the state's departments of health and human services in those states. This is already what is taking shape given the anti-abortion measures that have taken place in the last 10 years in those states. It's glaring, it's alarming, and this draft opinion shows just how egregious it is.
Professor Goodwin, I want to ask you two questions. One is, this is so unprecedented. I mean, in the court's history, has there ever been a release of a draft? And this is such a significant decision, but it has not come out. Is it conceivable, given what has happened, that one of these justices might change their mind? That's number one. And number two is, this is the judiciary. I'm looking at a tweet of Nina Turner, who is running for Congress in Ohio, today the election is taking place. She says, protecting abortion rights is not a midterm pitch. Democrats have the power now. We have the majority in Congress and we have the White House. Instead of drafting fundraising emails tonight, our elected leaders should be in D.C. voting to codify Roe and getting rid of the filibuster. So making Roe v. Wade the law of the land legislatively, if you could answer both.
Yeah, so let me start with the second part, which is that making Roe the law of the land, the Women's Health Protection Act is the legislation that has been promulgated in Congress. It's gone through the House, but it's not been able to make its way through the United States Senate. It would codify Roe. And I should just say that for those who really care about not just reproductive rights, but reproductive justice, Roe doesn't actually go far enough, but this would be incredibly important, the passage of the Women's Health Protection Act. It is sound legislation. It is important that that legislation is enacted, absolutely. But to your first question, which is whether there might be a justice that could potentially change his or her mind, there is the potential for that to happen. After first drafts of opinions, there are times in which there are justices that are moved to the other side of the boat. Will that happen with these particular justices? You know, Amy, I think it's important that we add to the conversation here that Justice Alito authored another important decision that was extraordinary, and it was the Hobby Lobby case. And in that case, Justice Alito also did a similar dance, which was to say that it's only about this particular decision. We can't look at it beyond. And what that was striking down part of the Affordable Care Act, essentially saying that organizations, for-profit companies, could have religious identities and that those religious identities would allow them to reject part of federal law, which is to make available through their insurance programs contraception. There were a series of companies that said that we find ourselves to be religious, which was something that the Supreme Court had never upheld before. And that secondly, we conflate contraception with abortion and therefore sought that the Supreme Court would essentially agree to the same. And the Supreme Court did in an opinion that was written by Justice Alito. And Justice Alito said, well, this only applies to companies that have these kinds of religious views. It doesn't expand beyond this. So a company can't say we have religious views and we oppose, let's say, blood transfusion and therefore deny people who work for us from getting blood transfusions. So a justice could change their mind, and it is possible that the Women's Health Protection Act could be enacted, but neither of those things are happening today.
I'd like to go back to Kitty Colbert to ask you. You wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times last year predicting the likelihood of Roe v. Wade being overturned by the court. But you wrote, quote, the end of Roe need not herald the end of an era of reproductive freedom. It may instead launch a new strategy that protects the fundamental human right to decide whether to have children and raise them in safety and dignity. Could you expand on that and what you meant there in terms of how the movement needs to move forward?
Sure. So, you know, our movement for many, many years has depended on the courts and has depended particularly on the U.S. Supreme Court to protect these rights. But our opponents have focused on the legislative arena, have focused on electing anti-abortion legislators at the state level and in Congress. And yes, we can turn this around. How? By electing people who support women's equality, who support reproductive justice and rights, and who are committed in every single way to ensuring that women have access to safe, legal abortion and a whole panoply of reproductive freedoms that are necessary to protect their health. What does that mean? It means that we need to focus on electing champions for choice. And we can only do that by hard work. It took our opponents almost five decades to get where they have gone. But let's not forget that this was their strategy, and we too can turn it around. But That means that every single person listening has to commit themselves to working legislatively to flip from red to blue state legislators and Congress people. Because until Congress is able to act, until the Senate has either changes the filibuster rule or elects 60 members who are with us on this issue, we're not going to see that kind of change on a national level. But we can see change at the state level. We can beef up the states that are purple and make them blue. We can make sure we elect pro-choice governors in many states who can veto bad legislation. It is too late to make changes in many, many places right now, but there is an election every 6 months in this country, and we need to be active and involved in those elections to make these changes.
I mean, there has been a very serious question about whether Democrats, progressives will be particularly galvanized in the midterm elections. I mean, this certainly could be a big deciding factor, to say the least. But Kitty Colbert, I want to put that same question of the removing the filibuster to you about the possibilities right now as opposed to the long term. We know that both Manchin and Senator Sinema have said they are opposed to that. But do you think there is a possible move in that direction? You have Democrats controlling the presidency, the Senate, and the House.
Well, I would hope so. If there's ever an opportunity to have them change their mind, this would present just one. But first of all, it's not going to happen without a huge public outcry. That means calling senators from your state and every other state as quickly and as often as possible and make sure they hear our anger. But we also can't forget that politicians at all levels of our system vote on these issues and are controlled in the most part by our votes. And so we need to send the message not just to the Senate, but to those state legislators who have bought into the Republican strategy and say it's time for you to find a new job. There's lots of gubernatorial races across this country, in Georgia, in Texas. One of the best messages we could send is to retire the governors in those states who are Republican, who are anti-choice, and say to the country, we are able to elect our people, and we think this issue is just too important to ignore.
And what about the significance of Chief Justice Roberts? What does it mean that he would uphold the ban but was not willing to overturn Roe v. Wade? Now, again, this is a draft. Things could change. This hasn't been released. The final decision could come as late as the beginning of July.
Well, I would say, Amy, that A, the Chief Justice is irrelevant. It only takes five votes. Remember, five is the key number. But more importantly, the only way that the Chief Justice could uphold this ban is to say that states have the ability to define viability on their own. And that means that the next week, the next state is going to say the ban starts at 14 weeks or 13 weeks or 12 weeks. There is no way under the current law for the Chief Justice to uphold a 15-week ban without so undermining Roe and Casey that they are essentially meaningless. So I really think that's a red herring. It's not something that's true to the way the law works, and the rights we know are really controlled by the five ultra-conservative justices, and I don't see any wiggle room there. These are not people who are concerned about women's health and women's equality. They have an agenda. They've been put on the court to enact their agenda, and that's what they're doing.
Catherine Kitty Colbert, we thank you so much for being with us. Lawyer who argued the landmark case of Planned Parenthood versus Casey before the U.S. Supreme Court in 1992, credited with upholding Roe v. Wade. She's co-founder of the Center for Reproductive Rights, co-author of Controlling Women, What We Must Do to Save Reproductive Freedom. And thanks also to Michelle Goodwin, the Chancellor's Professor at University of California, Irvine, author of Policing the Womb. Next up, as President Biden seeks $33 billion more dollars for Ukraine, we look at the dangers of U.S. military escalation with Medea Benjamin of Code Pink and George Beebe of the Quincy Institute, former head of Russia analysis at the CIA. He's also former advisor to Vice President Dick Cheney. Stay with us.
Había tremendo flow, pila de aborigen y a la bola, haciendo cacerola, jugando jabalina, los 100 metros. Guantánamo, está rico igual, me eché un sol, fue para relajar. Qué duro fue casualidad, me recogió una cosa, fuimos a pasar de agua, directo pa' los socios, recatamos el espíritu, soltamos el punta, por reformé el pendel, eso partiendo la piedra. Fuimos a parar a jibar, pa' comer cangrejo, pescado bien bueno, limpiamos el cuero con agua salada. Seguí para la tuna, encontrame a la India en el parque, aprieta como va.
En Plaza de Armas, Camagüey, tumbaron 8 y eso no.
West Cuba by Simafunk. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has called for the strongest possible military response against Russia. Pelosi made the comments in Poland Monday after she became the highest-ranking U.S. official to visit Ukraine. During a meeting there with the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, Pelosi vowed the United States would keep backing Ukraine militarily until the fight is done.
We believe that we are visiting you to say thank you for your fight for freedom, that we are on a frontier of freedom, and that your fight is a fight for everyone. And so our commitment is to be there for you until the fight is done.
Pelosi's surprise trip to Ukraine came just days after President Biden asked Congress for an additional $33 billion for Ukraine. This comes as evidence grows that the war in Ukraine is increasingly becoming a proxy war between Russia and the United States and its NATO allies. Last week, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said the U.S. wants to see Russia, quote, weakened. Over the weekend, Russia Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said the U.S. and NATO should stop arming Ukraine if they're really interested in resolving the Ukraine crisis. Well, we're joined now by two guests. Medea Benjamin is co-founder of the anti-war group Code Pink. We usually speak to her in Washington, D.C. Now she's in Havana, Cuba. George Beebe is also with us. He's Grand Strategy Director at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. His recent piece is headlined, Tell Us How This War in Ukraine Ends. He's a former director of Russia analysis at the Central Intelligence Agency and was special advisor on Russia to Vice President Cheney from 2002 to 2004. He's author of the 2019 book, The Russia Trap, How Our Shadow War with Russia Could Spiral into Nuclear Catastrophe. George Beebe, let's begin with you. You wrote the piece, Tell Us How This War in Ukraine Ends. So why don't you tell us? The latest news is that it may well be that the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, will announce the war on Ukraine on May 9th, Victory Day in Russia, when they beat the Nazis in 1945.
Well, I think that's quite possible.
Russians have been speculating for quite some time that Putin might take this step of moving from what he has called a special operation in Ukraine into a full-fledged and declared war, which would mean a national mobilization, widespread conscription of Russian soldiers and their use in the battle in Ukraine. So what that would mean would be that Russia would be gearing up for all-out war in Ukraine. And the context for this, of course, would be that Putin would argue that this is not actually a war between Russia and Ukraine, that this is a much larger war between Russia and the United States and NATO. That's how Russian elites and Putin have been depicting this conflict actually for many years, well before Russia's actual invasion of Ukraine on February 24th. They think that Ukraine is simply a pawn in this much bigger geopolitical game. And they think the stakes are astronomically high for Russia. They think that this is a fight for Russia's survival, that the stakes are existential. So if you're looking at this war and asking, how does this end and when does it end? That's a very bad sign, because it suggests that the Russians are gearing up for a very long-term conflict here. And the same thing, I think, is going on the American side as well. What we've seen in the last few weeks is rhetoric, which more and more openly discusses our goal being victory over Russia, Russia's strategic defeat, the weakening of its military, the marginalization of Russia as a player in the world. And some U.S. officials, including President Biden, have even alluded to the possibility of Putin leaving power, regime change. So what we're seeing, I think, on both sides is escalation. Escalation in the objectives, I think, that they're seeking. And with that escalation of objectives, I think the likelihood that this turns into a direct military clash between the United States and Russia goes up. So this is a very dangerous moment, I think.
And Georgie, I'd like to ask you, in terms of this new call for $33 billion in aid that President Biden has made to Congress for Ukraine, this is an astounding amount of money. I looked at, for instance, of U.S. foreign aid to the entire Latin America and Caribbean region has averaged over the last 60 years about $3 billion annually. And yet many Americans are so worried about the increasing flight of so many people from Latin America across the U.S. border, but yet we're giving so little aid to the countries there, and yet somehow we come up with $33 billion. Is this what is the signal that the Biden administration is sending by such a huge request, a big portion of it being military aid, but also direct foreign aid to Ukraine?
Well, budgets, of course, are reflections of a government's priorities. You can't do everything. We don't have infinite resources, so you have to make choices about what's more important and what's less important. And this is an enormous sum of money that the Biden administration is requesting. It comes on top of a lot of money that's already been spent on this effort in Ukraine, not just in the United States, but on the part of our NATO allies as well. So this is a very big effort, but it also says something about where the Biden administration's priorities really are on this. And I think it's fair to say, if you look at the numbers, that there are very few things that the Biden administration thinks are more important right now than defeating Russia. And I don't think that that accords actually with the priorities of the American people, but I think that's up for them to decide.
And I'd like to bring Medea Benjamin into the discussion. Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I wanted to ask you further. There had been a prior attempt, obviously, at reaching a peace accord in Ukraine, the Minsk Accords. Could you talk about what happened, why those Minsk Accords failed?
Well, the Minsk Accords go back to the outbreak of this war in Ukraine back in 2014. That had its origins in a tug of war between the European Union and to some degree NATO on the one hand and Russia on the other hand. And it was really about Ukraine's geopolitical fate. The European Union had been negotiating with the Ukrainian government for many months about an association accord. And that would, I think, allow greater trade and commerce and interaction between Ukraine and the EU. And that held the prospect of a very bright economic future for Ukrainians. And a lot of Ukrainians felt that that was a wonderful thing. There are few populations in the world that don't look forward to greater economic prosperity. But the terms of that association agreement essentially said to Ukraine, you've got to make a choice. Either you have a very close and deepening trade relationship with the EU or with Russia, but not both. You can't have the same depth of trading with both Russia and the EU at the same time. Now, the Russians objected to that because, of course, they had longstanding relationships with Ukraine, very deep economic relationships, but also cultural and personal. And looming behind this was the threat that Ukraine would essentially move into NATO and the West at the expense of cordial relations with Russia. And for all kinds of reasons, the Russians found that profoundly threatening, including to Russia's vital security interests. Now, this tug of war over Ukraine tore the Ukrainian country apart because there were people in the western regions of Ukraine that were very, very European culturally and in their political orientation. There were parts of the eastern parts of Ukraine that were largely Russian-speaking and culturally Russian and were more oriented toward relationships with Russia. And as the people in the western parts of Ukraine urged that Ukraine turn westward, the people in the east felt threatened and they objected. This eventually broke out into an actual civil war. Violence erupted. And the great powers, of course, got involved, the United States on the one hand and Russia on the other hand. And fighting broke out. The Russians intervened covertly. They announced they would be annexing Crimea, which had been part of Russia up until the 1950s, when then Soviet Premier Khrushchev gifted Crimea from the Russian Federation to the Ukrainian Republic within the Soviet Union. And the Russians took it back. And this, of course, collapsed into this years-long war. And the West tried to find a way to end that fighting. And that ultimately resulted in the Minsk Accords, which were an attempt to try to find a settlement inside Ukraine that allowed the regions in Ukraine's east greater autonomy. It provided for the withdrawal of Russian forces, the holding of elections in the east, the guarantees of language rights in the eastern parts of Ukraine. The Russian speakers felt that Ukrainian nationalists were violating their linguistic rights. This was never implemented, largely because the Ukrainian nationalists were concerned that this was ultimately a formula to allow Russia to use the greater weight of the eastern regions within the Ukrainian state to veto any membership of Ukraine in NATO over time. And I think they were right. That was exactly why the Russians found the Minsk Accords appealing, that this is a way of guaranteeing that Ukraine would not join NATO over Russian objections. And that, you know, essentially fell apart as a result. The Ukrainians never were willing to implement it. The Russians were never willing to compromise on their insistence on those terms. And, you know, that played a big role in producing where we are today.
In addition to George Beebe, we do now have Medea Benjamin on the line with us. She's actually in Havana, Cuba right now. Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink. Medea, we're speaking to you on in the week when President Biden has asked for $33 billion more for mainly military aid, military weapons to Ukraine. Contrast that with the $22 billion asked for all of the U.S. dealing with COVID. And that has been summarily rejected by the Republicans and some Democrats, far less than the $33 billion. But I wanted to ask you about that and the Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin talking about W&W weakening Russia and winning, Ukraine winning. And overall, what you think needs to happen right now?
I think it's terrible that the U.S. on all levels, from the White House to Congress, are pushing this as either regime change or a winnable war when we know there is no winning in this. I want to hear them talking about what compromises are they willing to make. I want to hear them saying they're going to put their efforts into negotiations. I want to hear them say they're going to separate humanitarian aid and military support for Ukraine and get that humanitarian aid approved. And I want to see that the people of the United States understand that to support the people of Ukraine and stop the fighting, we need not to pour billions of dollars of more weapons in, but to say negotiations now. And that's why we're calling people to come out this weekend, next weekend, the following weekend, have rallies, download our flyers, get people to sign petitions saying we need to end this war and not allow it to keep spreading and turn into a nuclear holocaust. People can go to peaceinukraine.org to find more information.
And Medea, how would you see the prospects for a settlement, for an agreement, and what might that entail?
Well, certainly they've been outlined by Zelensky himself and by the Russians. I think the United States is one of the greatest obstacles to negotiations. We have to recognize a neutral Ukraine, non-expansion of NATO, and demilitarization of the region. And I do want to add one other thing, Juan, which is we're coming to the 40-year anniversary of the 1 million people out in Central Park saying no to nuclear weapons in 1982. We in the United States have to work with the people inside Russia, not only to end this war in Ukraine, but also to get serious about banning nuclear weapons like the UN treaty calls on the world to do.
Let me ask George Beebe. You have written that the advent of the cyber age has made the chances of escalation into direct East-West conflict much greater than during the Cold War while doing very little to reduce its potential destructiveness. Can you explain this? And also just acknowledging that today President Biden's in Alabama at a Lockheed Martin plant, at a weapons plant.
Well, I think the advent of the digital era has changed things in a couple of important ways. One is the information sphere, the media sphere. It's become increasingly segmented, and social media, Twitter and other platforms, I think, encourage outrage. That's what gets attention online. Not people are saying, you know, look, we have to look at this in a balanced way. It's complicated. We need to understand the dynamics of all of this. It doesn't tend to lend itself toward that kind of complexity and reason and evidence. The people that get attention are the ones that scream the loudest and provoke the most outrage. That actually makes the political context in which you can try to aim toward diplomatic settlements of things like that more difficult, not less. So that's one part of the problem. The other part of the problem is the blurring of things that used to be relatively clearly delineated. Espionage and warfare, for example, sabotage and strategic attacks. It used to be In the old days, that it was clear when you're gathering intelligence information, you know, you're using human agents or you're taking photographs from satellites or airplanes or you're eavesdropping on phone calls of various kinds. The person who was on the other end of those intelligence collection efforts knew that that was intelligence collection.
We have 5 seconds.
Okay. Today, if you intrude on someone's computer network, you can not only gather information, but you can destroy that network. You can sabotage it. And when you think about all the things that are connected to the internet, that becomes very dangerous in a crisis.
We have to leave it there. George Beebe of the Quincy Institute and Medea Benjamin of Code Pink. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
You're listening to WRCT, Pittsburgh. You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh here. My name is Steve, your host of the Deep Blues Hour. I'll be bringing you 60 minutes of classic and traditional blues in this next hour. We're going to hear from Memphis Slim, along with his buddy Jazz Gillum, with some nice piano blues. Charlie Patton recorded 1934, some final pre-war blues from the master who originated a lot of the Delta blues sound, Charlie Patton. Plus, we'll also hear from Snooky Pryor and his buddy Homesick James. It's a nice live version of Dust My Broom, a classic blues tune. It's all coming up here on this hour of the Deep Blues Hour. And to start things off, we're going to hear from Louis Jordan and his Timpani 5, recorded in 1940. There you go. Louis Jordan. This is called Lemonade on the Deep Blues Hour.
Yes, I'm looking for a chick that only drinks lemonade. I haven't found one yet, but I've been told that a few was made. Now you know the type, and I know them too. They stand at the bar drinking 10-cent brew. You ask them what they're drinking, though you already know. They'll say whiskey every time to make you spin your dough. That's why I'm looking for a gal that only drinks lemonade. I haven't found one yet, but I've been told that a few was made. I met a gal I thought was so fine. I begged her to please, please, baby, be mine. I took her out one Thursday night.
She got two shots of joy juice and was ready to fight. That's why I'm looking for a gal that only drinks lemonade. I haven't found one yet, but I've been told that a few was made. Is too powerful for a woman's frame. It'll make some simple and it makes other chicks insane. It can make a girl weighing 104 feel so powerful she'll think she could even whip Joe. This I know to be a solid fact, 'cause I fell for one a little while back. She was so sweet at the start of the night, but after two drinks, was nothing right. That's why I'm looking for a chick that only drinks lemonade. I'm tired of being broke the day after I get paid.